Hello, and welcome to the grand experiment known as Connectivity, Episode 8. In this episode, we're going to start out with some news discussion between myself, Andy, and Zach. We'll get in a lot of your questions and feedback and such in there. And then after that, Neil and Scott spend about a half an hour talking about Skyward Sword and its connection to the rest of the Zelda franchise.
Sitting here with Mr. Mike Sklens and Zachary Miller. What's up, guys?
Not much.
Hey, not a lot.
We're going to do what we do best, and that's talk about the weekend news since last week. Not a lot's happened. We've had a few things, largely Zelda-related, actually. But and then we're going to kind of touch back on a few topics we went over last week. We're going to really just burn it to the ground with this whole game pricing nonsense. We got some really good listener mail, and there was some really good talk back on last week's show thread. So I think we're going to read some of that in this episode and respond to it. So let's go ahead and kick it off. The first story this week is actually a Europe-specific story. Europe is getting a badass new Zelda-themed 3DS.
Yeah, I almost I've held out on getting a couple Nintendo systems in the past. Like, I didn't get an SP right away. I waited out to get a GBA SP because I figured, well, I'll wait, I'll get one for Christmas. Oh, and, you know, every Christmas Nintendo releases some crazy special color, like Mario Edition or whatever. And they released a version of the GBA SP that came with, I think a Donkey Kong Country game of some sort, and it came with, like, neon lime green, and I love it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I got that. I love that SP. It's so unique looking, and they always do special stuff like that. So I thought, well, maybe, you know, there's not a lot of 3DS games I want. Maybe I'll hold out and wait for, like, a special Zelda-themed 3DS or something. And then I thought, nah, I'll just buy it. And now they come out with this thing that looks like, although I was hoping for an all-gold one, but this black one with gold-like filigree is pretty nice looking.
It looks really nice. It's going to come out on November 25th in Europe only. I don't quite understand why we don't get it over here in the States, but that's just another question to throw to Reggie when you corner him at a restaurant someday. Maybe we will get it. I mean, it wouldn't be the most surprising thing in the world if they put this out over here eventually, but especially since it's being billed as a 25th anniversary system, and there ain't much time left for that, so if you're gonna do it, now would be the time, I suppose. It comes bundled with the Ocarina of Time 3D, which is a game that I beat today, by the way. It's
such a
great game. No, I it was a slow burn for me. I kind of put a lot of hours into it, like when I first got it, and then set it down for a really long time.
Oh, okay.
I think I didn't play it for a good month and a half to 2 months, and then finally I was like, you know what, game is fun, Zelda. So I picked it back up and started playing it again. I kind of wanted to game fack it and like get everything, but that.
Yeah, I haven't really. Well, I played a lot of Zelda 2, and then I just stopped.
The desire to complete the entire thing 100% like fell short pretty quick when I realized that I could just beat the game and be done with it.
Sure.
Also, part of that is I'm getting the review copy, or I'm borrowing Neil's review copy of Skyward Sword effective tomorrow, I hope, if the post office is nice to me. And I wanted to wrap up Ocarina before I even started.
Let me know if it's worth it.
I saw a video on Kotaku today, a little 30-second video of just, like, scenery in the game and how they made it look like a French Impressionist painting, and I was like, shit, this looks really pretty.
I'm excited about it. Like, I'm kind of done with any Zelda fatigue that I had been lingering for a little while there, and I'm ready. I'm ready to try to power through the entire thing in about a week and a half, so.
It's funny, looking back at Zelda 2, I was thinking a lot when I was playing it about how
I gave up on that shit, by the way.
A lot of people, I gave up on it. I just gave up on it not because I kept dying. I just sort of stopped like six temples in. I just haven't done the seventh and eighth temples. But it's kind of funny to me. Everyone like really shits on Zelda 2. It gets a lot of hate. But it is the most similar to the modern Zelda games of all the old Zelda games.
Yeah.
The way the overworld and the dungeons work. But see, it's still got that top-down perspective that makes it a little different.
Sure, sure.
Like, you can't jump.
Right. Well, I get to what you mean.
Well, in other Zelda 3DS news, they announced, or I'm not sure if it was actually announced. I'm going to go read the news story real quick to find out for sure. There is a new 3DS game in the Zelda series coming out sometime but they haven't actually said anything about it at all, really. They've just basically confirmed that,
yes, we
shock
will indeed
of all
be
shocks,
making a
there
Zelda
will be
game.
A Zelda game on the 3DS.
Do you think they'll make another Metroid game? I don't know, guys.
Yeah, someday. Probably.
Well,
on
maybe
something.
Not.
Numa said it's not a direct sequel to the previous Zelda titles, but it's going to feature a lot of what has been done on previous consoles. So, big shock, it's a Zelda game with a lot of elements of previous Zelda games.
Well, I think it's important that he said that it's going to take stuff from consoles, which means it's going to be more similar to something like Ocarina or Twilight Princess than it is to something like Minish Cap or something like that.
Or Phantom Hour shit.
Yeah.
I never literally never even touched Minish Cap.
Minish Cap is good.
I don't really like top-down Zelda. I hate to be the guy to decry it, but I much prefer... Maybe that's why I ended up liking Zelda 2 more than I thought I would, because it's not really top-down. It's, you know, the action is all side-scrolling.
You know, I've mentioned this in the podcast, but it's been a really long time. When I first joined staff, one of the first months that I was there, I decided to like replay the entire series from front to back, including the handheld versions. And I got really, really burned out. By the time I got to the Oracle games, I was so done playing that kind of a game. But then I jumped over to Ocarina and Majora, and I fell back in love with it. So I think I'm pretty much never going to play a top-down Zelda game again, at least not for a long time. Like Link's Awakening and the two Oracle games are so incredibly similar that I think I finished Oracle of Seasons, but Oracle of Ages was just not going to happen.
Ages was the one I had. I don't know.
Did you get Link's Awakening on the eShop?
No, because I had just played it a year or two ago.
Oh, okay.
And I played Minish Cap, but I also remember that Minish Cap took a lot of energy.
It did.
More energy than a Zelda game should. Yeah, the Kinstone thing. I didn't really love the shrinking part of it. I don't know. So I'm kind of, I also much prefer the 3D Zelda games, and I'm kind of glad that this new Zelda should be more like those than, say, the Oracle games. Anuma also mentioned that they're considering... Him and Miyamoto are considering putting out a remake of Majora's Mask.
Let's hope they do, because I never really played much of it.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan of Majora's Mask. I know that it's a polarizing title, but I kind of feel like, honestly, they have the assets done. How hard can it be to just take the assets from Ocarina of Time 3D and plug those into Majora's Mask? Because, honestly, that's like most of the work right there.
Yeah.
I don't know how much time has to go into like 3D-izing it, but I'd like to believe... that's largely just built into the engine, and they could port that engine over to Majora, I would hope.
Yeah.
It should be
pretty easy to do, which basically should mean that, you know, should be able to print money with it, so.
And Majora is also kind of built more into, like, chunks. It's an easier game, I think, to put on a handheld because there's a lot more preset time segments, I guess, if that makes any
sense.
That's
the whole game. Because
everything's built into these 3 days of playtime, and you could play through a day and then close your DS and come back to it later. I think those kinds of games are easier to put on a handheld than games that, you know, open-ended games that you could play for a long time. But I'd love to see a Majora's Mask remake, and it seems like they're pretty seriously considering it, and the only reason they're not putting it out right away is because they don't want to do two remakes in a row. So
yeah, and they need more content. Like, that's obvious. And if this is an easy way to get content that will sell well, like, why not do it?
I feel like there's a lot of real estate in the idea of that creepy-ass moon coming right at you.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm down with that, I say go for it, Nintendo. I know, I'll stop yelling at you for doing remakes if you do that particular remake.
There you go.
Speaking of Zelda again, we're still on the same topic.
Zelda cast! Never really died.
There is a Zelda 25th anniversary concert heading to Dallas in 2012, and it's the start of the 2012 tour, apparently. And I'm not sure how many stops that tour is going to be, but
you
got to
figure it's at least three.
Yeah,
I hope so.
They're playing in Dallas on January 10th, and you can actually get tickets for a 15% discount if you are a Club Nintendo member. So that's kind of cool. I would love to go to one of these, but the chances of them, you know, coming to Des Moines, Iowa, are fairly low, and I will not be able to travel for a little while due to, you know, children and whatnot. I'm excited about it. We actually
children?
Had
children. Are you having twins?
Well, no. I'm calling it. I'm calling my one child a children. We actually had a listener, Adolf Veda, our frequent contributor, offered to give us a couple of very brief 3D clips from his 3DS. Because he's actually headed to the concert in Dallas, and that's excellent. So we look forward to seeing your 10-second 3D clips.
I'm sorry you had to go to Dallas, Adolf.
You might be from Dallas. I don't know.
Okay, I'm sorry you live in Dallas, Adolf.
I've never been to Dallas. I've only been to Austin, and it was okay.
It's Texas.
Texas is Texas.
Yeah.
That's all we got for Zelda this week, but we do have a little bit of listener mail. Zach, you want to read this?
Sure. Let me grab my glasses here.
It's hefty. We're looking at 3-4 paragraphs.
A big old letter. All right, here we go. This is from Shaman, frequent forum contributor. Hello, connectivity team. It's team connectivity, damn it. I'm digging the new format, and it's cool.
It's connectivity.
Connectivity team.
Done.
I like that one.
I'm digging the new format, and it's cool that we get to hear from more of the staff at NWR. As it pertains to news discussion from Episode 7, I have to say that I'm not getting Resident Evil Revelations, but that's because I don't give a shit factor about RE games. I wouldn't have gotten it for $40, and the fact that it costs the same as Skyward Sword means there's no freaking way I'm getting it now. Although I hate how everything in gaming comes down to an East-West debate. Really? It does. The pricing of handheld gaming is one thing that is legitimately an East-West issue. Eastern developers, Capcom especially, get away with charging premiums for handheld games in their home country because they're bigger than consoles. They're charging 5,800 yen for Revelations and charging 5,800 for Monster Hunter 3D on the PSP, or third on the PSP, which as of the time of this email is a little over $74. Damn! Given the weakness of the US dollar and the British pound, someone called the Stonecutters stat, Japanese publishers have to sell at a higher price to make the same profit. Western developers, who have more influence from phone gaming, are less inclined to charge premiums for games on dedicated handhelds, since it's more of a fifth priority for them behind the HD PC trio, XBLA, PSN, and phone OSs. There you go.
Yeah.
$74 friggin' dollars. My God, how does anyone game
not
over
really,
there?
I mean, that's not really true, though. I mean, yes, that's what it is, but, like, you know, you can't just give it a straight dollar conversion because the economy's working differently.
Well, yeah, you're missing the context if you just convert it over right away.
Yeah, but that's still a lot of money.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, you know, here's the thing. If you're going to make games that require, like, that don't use optical media, like these DS games, they use, you know, flash memory storage. If you need more storage, the cartridge is going to cost more money because there's more chips in it, or the chips are higher density.
Right.
It's, you know, it's dollars and cents. If you want to make a game that needs more memory, the cartridge is going to cost more to produce, which means it's going to cost more for Capcom to buy it, which means that money's going to trickle down to the consumer, and you're going to pay $10 more.
It does kind of suck, though.
It does suck.
I'm just saying.
I still kind of stand by my comments that I don't feel like this should be a handheld game if that's the way it's going to be. Like, I don't know.
Here's the point. Yeah, that's the thing, is if they were going to make a game like this and put it out on a PSP, or I guess more simply, if the 3DS used optical media, it wouldn't matter. It would still fit on the optical media. Problem solved.
Right.
Like, yeah. It doesn't cost any more to put more space on the optical disc. The disc is limited in how much space it can hold, but it holds so much that you never really run into the problem of filling it up.
Isn't the Vita going to have some proprietary media form?
I don't even know how they're delivering games on the Vita. Are there going to be
a flash card or something?
But the Vita also has a fair amount of built-in internal storage, and you can download the games if you want to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so are Vita games coming on discs or cartridges? I don't even know.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how many options you've got as far as media delivery. physical media delivery.
You know, for handhelds, it's tricky. I mean, there's a good reason that the load times on the PSP were awful, and that's because they were trying to put a, you know, a fully fledged disc, like optical disc drive in the handheld, and it kind of sucked.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why Nintendo's always gone. You know, they've always preferred cartridges because cartridges are instant.
Yeah.
Right.
It's hardwired into the system. You know, you just plug in the connectors and it's part of the computer.
Right. Which I appreciate. You know,
yeah, it's definitely appreciable. And optical drives on consoles are not a big deal at this point. You know, they kind of spin fast enough where it's not that big of a deal, and you could do a lot of pre-caching to get around in load times. And but yeah, on something like, you know, handheld, you want it to be, it's got to be super quick because you have to, the game has to be able to put itself in a save state as soon as you shut the lid.
Dude, when I'm on the shitter, I don't want the game to load up as soon as I'm done.
You don't want to have the game to load while you're dropping a load, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Well, we got some really good comments in the talkback thread from last week's episode, because we spent, you know, a good 25 minutes last week with
Scott.
Was Neil, or was it Scott? My memory is shot. Talking about this exact thing. So let's go over some of these comments. I'll read the first one. It's from Enner. And Enner says, concerning the price of Resident Evil Revelations, is it a good or bad thing that the Western audiences hold portable games at such a lower value and to different expectations? Or is it just how the video game culture has formed for Western audiences, and it is unfortunate that there are different focuses in the Japanese video game industry? I would like to say that a great game is worth equally on whatever platform, but that is not true. I value portable console games lower and differently to PC and home console games.
Well, yeah, what do you guys think? How do you guys value, you know, a portable game versus a console game?
Well, I think I said in that, I responded in the thread last week and said that I think there's, you know, when Nintendo launched the Game Boy, games were like $30. It was back in 1988? And
something
they've
like
stuck with that price pretty consistently up till the 3DS.
Well, yeah, on the DS, every now and then something would creep out at like 35
or
40. Yeah, 35,
40, yeah.
Like Pokemon or something
like
that.
Square Taxi games, yeah. Or big first-party games where they know they can get away with it. But I think, you know, for 20-odd years, that became the norm. So now that they're charging $40 for games, I think that's why there's such a backlash, because people are saying, like me, are saying, well, you got away with charging $30 for 20 years for all these other games. What's going on here?
Here's an interesting question. If the Xbox and PlayStation 3 games are $60, that's market value for most games. Wii games are $50. If Wii games cost $60, would people be complaining about 3DS games costing $40?
Yes, because
I don't think they would
about Wii games costing $60,
well,
too.
They would. Okay, yeah, I guess that's kind of a separate discussion. I think the big difference is that it's now only $10 less than a Wii game.
Oh, I see.
If it was $20 less than a Wii game, you'd think, oh, well, yeah, because it's, you know, I'm paying, you know, that's a fair price. It's $20 less than a console game because it's portable. But now it's only $10 less than a Wii game.
Yeah.
Ocarina of Time for $40 is only $10 less than Skyward Sword. That kind of makes Ocarina of Time seem overly priced.
Well, I just feel like the real root of the problem is that we're in the situation now where the MSRP of games is based very little on the content of the game, the development cost of the game, the demand of the game. We have all these really like arbitrary static price points, like 50 for Wii, 60 for Xbox, 30 for DS, 40 for 3. Like it seems like that's bullshit. I mean, I don't want to pay $40 for Frogger 3D, and I'm happy to pay $40
for
Resident
Frogger
Evil.
Was Frogger 40 or 30? Because a lot of the more arcadey 3DS games are coming out at a more appropriate $30 price point.
I think Pac-Man and Galaga Dimensions was
I think 40,
they were, I'm pretty sure.
Was that one cartridge, though?
Yes.
That's how they got away with it.
So you'll never see a first-party published game at $30 or $35. If anything,
probably
the price
not.
Will go up. Like Pokemon.
Yeah, when Pokemon 3DS comes out, it'll be 45.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
I mean, say what you will about the low prices of iOS games devaluing, you know, handheld content, but at least iOS games are sold based on merit.
True.
You know, if a game took a lot of development time and has high end visuals, it's at the high end of the price spectrum.
Yeah, you know,
if it's not,
like Infinity Blade costs $10 and Angry Birds is a buck.
Oh, dude, did you guys see that Shantae came out on iOS.
Yeah, I downloaded it. Yeah, I saw
that. And it's $2 there.
Yeah, but it has it's a virtual D-pad, I virtual assume, D-pad. Right?
I tried it. It's no good. Oh, I mean, I never played the original, but I played it, you know, just played it on the iOS, on my iPhone 4S, and it was just like, no.
Wow. Well, maybe that explains
it. It seemed like a good game, but it was just like, it's not something, even at $2, I want to play it well. I don't want to play, you know, I don't care if I'm paying $38 less for it or $28 less for it. I want it to play well still.
Sure.
I just feel like the complaints about the Resident Evil price and, you know, being too close to a console game, that would be irrelevant if we lived in a world where things cost what they should and not what they do.
I agree.
Which I realize is a fantasy world, because then we're also talking, I mean, that's the way the economy works.
Yeah, I mean,
works.
Well, it's all the games have to be equally priced, otherwise, I don't know. Like, I feel like on some level, games for a console do have to be basically the same price. They can't vary more than $10, and the $10 is always $10 less, never $10 more. There's no $70 games out there.
No. I almost wish the pricing structure was more genre-based than platform-based.
It should be content-based. If you have a game that is you are going to spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours on, it should accordingly cost more. Or a game like Uncharted, I will pay $60 for an Uncharted game. I will pay $60 for an Uncharted game if they put one out every fucking month. Like, I don't care. They're good as shit. Yeah. I don't care if it's Dragon's Lair. Like, it's Dragon's Lair. I don't really care. Like, you hit the buttons and Nathan Drake does something awesome. I don't really care. It's really great. And it looks insanely good.
But the keyword is awesome.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah. And then a week later, Just Dance comes out and it's only $10 less.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't make any sense. I think Harmonix had the right idea. Rock Band 3 came out. They put it out at $60. But within less than a year, they dropped it $20.
Well, that happens a lot. I mean, with my PS3 purchases, I will often just wait a few months, and then the price will drop $20-$30.
But Harmonix is in a little bit of a different situation because they are making money off DLC. They have built a market DLC to the point where they can sell, like, consoles are sold for a loss, so you can make money on selling games. Harmonix is doing the same thing. They're selling their game, maybe not for a loss, but they're not making much money off a $20 copy of Rock Band 3.
Yeah.
But every time they sell one of those, that's more money in DLC. And if you give someone a $20 game, they're going to be more apt to buy DLC because you have saved them $40.
Uh-huh.
That's very
true. Because in a person's mind, all video games are $60 or at least maybe $40 or something like that. If you sell them Rock Band 3 that's been out for less than a year for $20, they're like, oh, now I have a little more money to burn to support this game.
All right, Mike, why don't you read the last forum comment for us?
Here's a message from E-Jammer. Once you move outside of the $20 to $30 range, games become a much tougher purchase. Part of the reason I'm not keen on buying any of the currently available 3DS games. At $40, a game becomes a real investment for me and something that I need to feel confident I will enjoy and invest a considerable amount of time with. Oddly, there is no difference in my reluctance to pay $40 or $50, though. If I'm confident enough that the game is worth $40, it's probably worth even more to me. This is something I learned about in my marketing classes in college way back when. It's called I can't remember the name of it now, but it's like a psychological pricing point where, like, as you get up in prices, the difference between price A and price B can get greater.
Oh.
Like, if I'm willing to pay $2 for something, I might not be willing to pay $3 for it. But if I'm willing to pay $17 for it, I'm probably willing to pay $24. It's called, like, least noticeable price difference or something like that. And you want to target your product at the highest end of that bracket.
Yeah.
If you price something at $18 or $17, and if you also priced it at $20, if 90% of those people would still pay $20, guess what? You should be charging $20 instead.
Yeah.
That's what that is.
Yeah, I read something sort of talking about the microtransaction price model once, and they were basically they're talking about, like, the mental barriers of various price points and how the biggest mental barrier is, like, literally at free or not free. Like, an app that's free will outsell an app that costs a penny a million times over just because there's no decision involved whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I think that's applicable. I mean, we're not talking about free games here, but I think there's a lot of barriers along the way, even if the most significant one is at zero.
This is something that I always end up talking about Apple on these podcasts, but this is something that Apple has been very keen on, and they're smart. They realize $99 is the mental price point for a song.
Like dollars?
I'm sorry, 99 cents. 99 cents is the mental price point for a song. Oh, come on, Zach.
Harsh.
That's cold. That's cold. But no, I was going to relate this directly over to the eShop. Nintendo can't get this through their skull. You can't find anything on the eShop for less than $2.
No,
or $1.99.
Yeah,
they don't realize
true.
That 99 cents is a psychological price point. So is $99. If something costs $110 or $99, you're probably going to sell a shitload more of them if you just knock the $10 off and make it 99 bucks.
Right, right.
It's not even that like you can't find anything cheaper than $2. It's that the average games are $5 and the good games are $10.
Right.
Like there are no budget priced games on the download services.
Yeah, and if you're looking on the virtual
unless they're virtual console games.
If on the eShop, you're looking at virtual console games are $3 to $6. It's ridiculous.
Can I bitch about Apple real quick?
Go for it.
Okay, my iPod is like 7 years old. It's an iPod video. It's an 80 gig. It's got dust under the screen. It you know, doesn't turn off sometimes. Sometimes it just freezes. It doesn't recognize when the computer is connected to it. It's just become a piece of shit. But I can't get an iPod that has a good amount of memory for less than $300.
Well, I moved over to flash memory away from hard drives. That's why that is.
Really?
Well, all the old iPods, like your iPod video that still has a click wheel on it, that's got a hard drive in it.
Right.
But the new iPods, they don't sell iPod. I mean, I think they still sell the iPod Classic. I think you can actually still buy it.
And that costs $250.
Right, but it holds a fucking insane amount of stuff.
No, it's like 160 gigs, more than I'll ever need.
Yeah, that's an insane amount of stuff.
I think you'd find, Zach, how much did you pay for your iPod video?
I don't know. It was a prize.
That's the thing is the prices. The prices haven't like gone up.
Apple doesn't change the prices on their products. They change the features every year to make them more appetizing.
Well, anything they've gone
changing the prices.
Slightly down over time because I think the iPod Touch was costing like $300 to $500 when it first came out, and now it's like $200 to $400.
Yeah,
what is their profit margin on these things?
It's pretty healthy.
Oh yeah, it's certainly pretty healthy. I mean, once they start having sales problems, that may change, but. Hasn't been a concern
They're
for them for a long
have
time.
Problems.
But like my iPod's going to die on me, and I can't afford to get a modern one. I mean, that kind of bugs me, and doesn't it bug Apple even a little? Like if they lowered their price even by $50, so that the iPod, the 32 gig iPod Touch cost $250 or $200 instead of $300, I think they'd get a whole lot more people interested in it.
Maybe, but they've got a bunch of really brilliant mathematicians and marketers that figure out price points for all that shit.
I think I mean
they know
I
where
agree,
the sweet
Zach,
spot
that
is for their products.
It's not cheap, but I've never felt like in the iPod Touch or any of the iOS devices are. I don't feel like you're getting ripped off for those devices. I feel like the amount of engineering to get those devices the way they want them.
I read a good analogy earlier this week. I think it was probably on Daring Fireball, so obviously it's like super fucking biased. But it was basically like, you know, if you walked into a Ferrari dealer and looked at the cost of the parts that went into a Ferrari, you'd be like, holy shit, this Ferrari is really fucking overpriced. You'd be like, no, because it's a motherfucking Ferrari. Like, how much? You're not paying for the parts, you're paying for the engineering and the design. And that's a lot of what you're paying for with Apple products.
I see.
Zach,
and it's
why
not
does
that
the 3DS cost so much?
Yeah. That's a whole different story.
Zach, what I would suggest to you, since like price is sort of an issue with you know replacing your iPod, and because I don't get the impression you're particularly married to the idea of owning an Apple product, fuck, go on eBay and buy a Zune. Those have got to be
or
fucking
buy
clearance
an iPod,
prices by
buy
now.
Buy last generation's iPod.
Yeah, that too.
Apple really, sells those refurbished.
But I want to be able to play games on it.
Well, you could buy last generation's iPod Touch on Apple's on store. They sell them on the clearance section.
Zach, talk to former staffer Grant Buell. Okay. I'm willing to bet he's going to be selling his iPod Touch in a few months.
I'm gonna write that down for myself
because he's
right
buying
now.
An iPhone and he's buying an iPhone in December and he has a 64 gig iPod Touch right now.
Or just get a friend who works at the Apple Store because they can knock 15% off.
For 2 years old. I'm not sure what he'll ask for it. But it's the most an iPod Touch has for as far as storage is concerned. So he may ask for a little bit more for it. But talk to him, because my guess is he may be looking to sell.
I've got a Mike. You said Apple friend. I don't have a friend at the Apple store, but I have a friend who's the biggest Apple apologist you've ever met. I mean, he makes you sound like a hater for Apple. I mean, Apple could sell all their stock tomorrow and go into the construction industry, and he would find a way to put a positive spin on that. It irritates me.
Do we have any other news, gentlemen?
No, I think we've been done with news for 15 minutes now, actually. So.
I'm well. I've come off about a week-long love affair with this chick named Zelda. she gave me a Skyward Sword, if you know what I mean.
Whoa! Oh. Man, Zach's not even here. Yeah. This kind of innuendo. This is great. But yeah, so I brought Neil on to talk about Skyward Sword.
Yeah.
He's beaten the game now, and he's written his review.
Yeah, and you will have read the review by the time this episode is up, so
that's true.
I guess I gave it a 10, and it was a very hard fought 10, because I was actually talking to Scott before the show about how I believe I tweeted something about like anyone who gave this game a 10 is crazy or something like that. And then kind of as I worked through it, like in my head I was like, you know what, it's good, it's not that good, but just as I kept on playing more of it, I fell more in love with the game until it got to the point where I feel like if I gave it anything less than a 10, it was just because I didn't want to give it a 10. So that's when it just was clear to me, because basically all my complaints, they're really, really nitpicky, and the overall game is fantastic, and any Nintendo fan who doesn't get this game is crazy.
Well, you've heard it here first. And I'll just let everyone know who's listening that this should be a relatively spoiler-free chat. We're going to kind of talk overall themes of the game, controls and stuff like that. But down the road, probably next episode, or at least within two episodes here, Andy, who's playing the game now, will join Neil and probably other staff members by that time, and we'll probably get into a little bit more of a spoiler chat.
And you can also, I'll plug my little bit on the live show for the NWR live podcast for Child's Play. That's on Saturday, November 19th, so a week after you hear, or after this is posted. I'll be doing an hour-long segment. I believe it's the second or third segment in the entire, or I think it's for hour three of the live show. So I think we're pretty much guaranteed to be running it, but I'm going to be hosting a kind of round table on Skyward Sword with a couple people from other outlets that are also reviewing it. So, you know, we might have some professionals in there in addition to, you know, the amateur that I am. And Andy might be a part of that too, depending on how far he is in the game at that point.
Right. Well, great. So you should be safe from spoilers here. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. But I guess kicking things off, I wanted to start with controls specifically, because I think that was your initial gripe. And we even got an email a little while ago. We've been kind of holding it on until we had this conversation from a user Tansun. I'm not entirely sure how you would pronounce that. But
and tell us how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
Connectivity at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Exactly. Phonetically spell that for us. He had a pretty long email. I'm not going to read the entire thing here, but let me read the first paragraph here. He says, In episode 3, you discussed Skyward Sword's control scheme and how it never really came to mind that you have to use the Motion Plus with it. I got to play the demo at PAX, and ever since then, the Motion Plus controls come to mind every time the game is brought up. Unfortunately, I don't mean that in a good way. I found the controls awkward, frustrating, and unintuitive, and it was easily the least fun I have had playing any Zelda game. The worst part is, I don't think it would have been as much of a problem if they had gone with the standard control scheme instead of Motion Plus. He goes on his email to kind of talk about some of the various struggles he had, basically kind of orienting the controller and getting it to do quite what he wants. And then he also says that he did calibrate the controller before playing, so that shouldn't have been an issue. But yeah, but I know, Neil, I think initially you had maybe a similar complaint.
Well, I think I would also say, I mean, give the caveat with the demo. I mean, it's a work in progress, so I mean, I don't think there was really any huge issues with the demo. But that could have been part of the reason why you had trouble with it, because it wasn't the finished product. But even right, still, I did notice.
I'm sorry. I was gonna say, I just wondered too, if playing it in that environment, if there was any sort of interference or anything.
Yeah. Well, I actually
Famous Miyamoto demo where he couldn't get the game to really work.
The demo was leaked. I don't know how it was leaked, but basically NeoGAF has been talking up a storm about it, and people have like analyzed it. They've actually basically pulled out details on the entire game's plot from this demo first appeared at E3 2011 and has been in basically every possible show Nintendo's been at since. And I believe, I think there's some, they found some sort of date on it, and it's from like late 2010. So, I mean, that demo is a year old at this point. It was already a number of months old when it was first shown, and it's been a couple of months since that. So, I mean, that could be a little of your troubles there. But I do have to say, from, you know, going to this game, you know, I had played the demo, but not to the point where, you know, I memorized it or anything. I kind of more just, you know, played the demo to enjoy the demo. I think I only really played the dungeon area once during E3, and at New York Comic Con, as I mentioned in the other episode, I basically just, you know, was going through the motions because I wanted to get a free t-shirt, because that's how I am. It's a nice t-shirt, by the way. But what I did notice from playing this game is that when I started off, I was kind of frustrated by the controls. I wouldn't say that they were bad or that they were unresponsive, but it's just like I didn't quite get it. And I know I've talked, Scott, I think I even talked to you about this. I've talked to this with a lot of people when I first started playing it, about how I always kind of see the 3D Zelda games as kind of this like incremental upgrade. I mean, yeah, they all follow the same general formula, but there's like little improvements each way. And having, you know, replayed Ocarina, Wind Waker, bits and pieces of Twilight Princess over this past year, I've noticed that even more so. Like in Ocarina of Time 3D, I kind of was reminded of like kind of how boring that the combat is in that game. It's really simple and basic. And then in Wind Waker, they add the parrying system. And then Twilight Princess, they add even more on top of that with the parrying. And then you do all these different moves that, I mean, that was the moment that clicked with me in Twilight Princess, was when I think it's you get like the second or third sword power. It's been 5 years since I fully replayed this game. Well, replayed this game. I've never fully replayed it afterwards. But I just remember, you know, doing those motions where like you'd spin around the enemy and pop up. Like I love doing that. Right. And when I was playing Skyward Sword, it's like the combat at first didn't really seem wholly different. Like, it just felt like, it didn't feel like a leap forward, it felt more like a sidestep. And that's kind of how the game felt in general, is that it kind of was like this fuzzy recollection of what the, you know, Twilight Princess and Wind Waker and Ocarina were. And it was just kind of like, yeah, this is just like kind of an alternate universe take on that with Motion Plus. It's crazy. And that was really for probably, you know, the first 5 hours or so, that was my experience with the game. And it's not I didn't think it was bad at all. It's still a Zelda game. And that's really, I mean, you can say what you want about Phantom Hourglass, but when that shit goes on an N64 or GameCube or a Wii, you know you're getting quality. Even if it's Link's Crossbow Training, because let's get real, Link's Crossbow Training, for what it was, is actually kind of good. But I mean, it was a great game. It's just the controls weren't really selling me on it. The combat wasn't really selling me on it. And I don't really know when it clicked, but probably, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10 hours into the game, or maybe even more, everything just clicked for me in motion. Like, I feel like going back to any other Zelda game, I toyed with replaying Twilight Princess kind of after this, because I sent my copy off to Andy so he could play it before he has a baby. But I thought about going back to play Twilight Princess, and I don't know if I could, because the controls in this game are kind of that, they're that big of a deal. They make the game that much better. like, I mean, that there are bosses and combat sequences and even puzzles that straight up could never be done in a Zelda game except for with these controls. And that's kind of what this does, is the abstract of my review is actually with – it's something along the lines of, with one game, Nintendo justified the existence of Wii Motion Plus, and it's true. Like, this is – it's that good, at least with the controls. I mean, I could hear people, you know, picking apart some of the structure of the game. Personally, I won't. I think it's very good. But as far as the controls, like, it's wonderful. And I – you know, you might run into some calibration issues. But the cool thing is that it actually doesn't use or at least I guess maybe it doesn't entirely use a sensor bar as a pointer. It uses, like, Wii Motion Plus. I think, like, Conduit 2 does it, maybe another first-person shooter or something, like Red Steel 2. But, sure. Like, there was actually one point where – well, I guess what you do is that I think when you have the game paused, you can just tap down on the D-pad, and it'll just kind of make, like where you're pointing will be the new center. So okay. I actually kind of, like, I was, like, lazily sitting on my couch, and I actually had my hands, like, kind of above my head with the pointer on the Wii remote pointing away from the TV, and I just calibrated it there. And albeit it was pretty terrible because I basically had to play, like, backwards. but, like, I could do it. Like, I could do it where I'm pointing away from the TV, and I could, you know, point on screen and, like, fire the beetle and guide it around and stuff. It was really difficult, but the fact that I could do that, you know, it's kind of novel. But really, just the way everything feels, I mean, like, it's smooth. It's like there's kind of like no break in gameplay. And I know that this was something that I think Miyamoto or Inuma talked about in E3 2010 when they showed the first demo. The idea of that you don't have C buttons. You don't go into the menu screen to change items. It's kind of like you press the B button and a kind of overlay will pop up on the screen. Like there's no stoppage of time. And you just kind of, you know, point to the weapon that you want. You know, you could have the slingshot and you're just like, ah, screw it. I need the bombs here. And you do that and everything's still going on around you. But that just works because there's really like no pause in gameplay. I mean, you can go, there's a gear screen, there's a map screen. But when you're actually in it, it's like combat gets intense because you don't really have a way out. And even more so because in this game they have shields that can break, which is kind of a dick move. I'm going to be completely honest because so they got these shields that you can get. And I wrote about this a little bit. This might be a little spoilery, so just kind of like go ahead a minute. But they have shields and you start off with a wooden shield and that, you know, get burnt by fire. And then the metal shield has a weakness against electricity, which is kind of cool because it makes it so it's not just a better, bigger, better deal. And then later there's a shield that you can buy, and you have to buy all these. I think you might be given the initial one, but after that you're never given a shield. You have to buy them. And there's a shield that will protect against both of it, but it's really brittle. But it like recharges health. It's kind of weird. And the shields don't break just from regular use. It's when you misuse it. So basically you have to do this kind of shield bash move that will kind of like deflect enemies' attacks and stun them. And if you don't do that right, your shield's going to break in like 3 hits. And it's a bitch because you can upgrade them with all the stuff that you collect. And you can do that with pretty much every weapon in the game. But if that upgraded shield breaks, you're screwed. You need to buy the basic shield and upgrade it up again.
And start over. Wow.
Yeah. And there's even another part regarding the shields later in the game that I can't talk about. But I actually missed it on my first playthrough. But then someone told me about it. And it's another thing where it's just like, it just seems like a real dick move, but I kind of like it. It's a little brutal in that regard, but I think also, and I think once again, someone like Inuma or one of the developers on the game made a comment about how if the shields didn't break, you would be too overpowered because you'd always be protected.
Right.
And I talked a whole lot, so.
That's okay. I mean, I guess that's just another step in sort of fleshing out the combat and making it more.
Yeah.
I mean, like you said, like making it more important to the game and not just like how it was in Ocarina of Time where, you know, it's just you press a button and that's
yeah, it's like combat is a gigantic deal in this game, and some of the bosses are spectacular because of it. Some of them still kind of suck, but for the most part they are excellent because you legitimately have like the sword in your hand. That's what you're moving around, and there's several boss battles with that. Actually, the first one in the game, which was at the E3 2011 demo, and is also, you know, the demo that's been circulating with Girahim, the big villain in this. And the first boss right off the bat, it's not the typical, you know, rule of three or anything. It's not even like you know, like how you go to the end of the Deku Tree and it's Queen Goma. No, you're fighting the guy who's basically the recurring final boss, mm-hmm. and you fight him at the end of the first dungeon. And, I mean, it's a sword fight. It's a straight-up sword fight.
Wow. Well, that's something I was going to ask, too, was as far as boss structure, I've kind of been hearing that it's not so much how it was in the past, where you get an item in a dungeon, and then that item is, like, key to beating the boss.
It's kind of weird. Because it's like, someone was asking me this question. I think it was staff member Nick Bray, I think, mentioned it about asking or saying he was disappointed that the overworld doesn't seem to be as expansive as in Twilight Princess, which I don't really think is a bad thing, because I thought that the overworld in Twilight Princess was really big and barren, but not just me. And the way this kind of works is that, you know, you start off in Skyloft. That's, you know, the whole introductory sequence, which isn't as long as Twilight Princess, thank Christ. but then you have the bird, the Loftwing, that you can fly around, and that's basically your overworld. It's almost kind of like the ocean in Wind Waker. You know, like, you have a lot of downtime when you're going between places. Sometimes it gets a little monotonous, but, you know, you use motion plus the whole time during that to control everything with the bird, which is still kind of funny. They have, like, when you swim and when you're flying with the bird, you just use motion plus. And I still would find myself holding the nunchuck, moving the analog stick around, trying to control it. I'd be like, why isn't it going? Oh, yeah, I need to tilt it with motion plus, not with the analog stick. But, so you go around there. There's a lot of side quests there. There's actually one side quest that I feel is worth mentioning, because I actually saw someone on Twitter talking about the Majora's Mask one, where you need to get, like, the couple together. And it's also, like, you can take the love letter and give it to the demon who's in the toilet or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There is something that basically is that in this game. And it took, like, I first did it, and I was just kind of like, well, that's weird. And then it took someone mentioning Majora's Mask to me that I was like, oh, my God, that's why it seemed so familiar. So that's kind of novel how they did that. I mean, they brought in an aspect from an older game that, you know, I mean, this is the culmination of, in my eyes, the entirety of 3D Zeldas. And that's kind of what I feel like 3D Zelda, every new 3D Zelda should be. It shouldn't just be the next game. It should be like, you saw those other ones, we're bringing the best parts of that into the here.
Right.
But what were you... Oh, yeah, so the overworld. The overworld in the air, there's a lot of side quests, little small islands you can go to. And then there's these different pillars in the air, that, like, these pillars of light that kind of act as beacons. And that's where you go to the underworld. It's the land beneath the clouds. And that's where it's kind of, you drop into these, like, sandbox areas almost that are kind of linear. So you drop down in these areas that are kind of linear as you kind of work your way through, but it's like these different sandbox areas. So, you know, in the first area, it's the forest, and you drop down and you'll go through a couple paths, and then it'll open up into this area, you know, with the token big tree. And you'll, you know, complete a lot of puzzles and stuff in that area. And then you'll move on to another area and, you know, do some stuff there. And then you'll go to the dungeon. But it's like, along that way, you got a new weapon. And you're basically solving puzzles to get there. So it's kind of like the moment you hit the ground, you're in a dungeon. As opposed to, you know, you're just kind of... Maybe you need to get a certain item or something to progress and you have to walk down a path. But no, it's like you're solving puzzles to get to the dungeon. And there's some spots where I got through the area and I'm like, when's the dungeon going to happen? And I'm like, oh, I just beat a boss. I guess what I just went through was the dungeon. It's not really a formal dungeon. It's sneaky about it.
Right. It's not like a building you walk into or some kind of structure and then that's the dungeon and then you can leave at any time. It's kind of the whole environment once you
leave. And I mean, it does still retain that structure. You know, there's a pretty rigid three-act structure to the game. You still have, you know, collect these three things, then collect more things, then collect more things, then win. But it just kind of works because the way it just keeps it fresh throughout the entire time. You know, you're not just, you know, go to this town, get into the dungeon in this town, bail. It's like, you go to this area, you do this new thing in this area, you get a new weapon, and then you do this thing, and then you get a new weapon, and you go through this thing that you've never done before and is really cool looking, and then leave.
And then I guess, like I had asked originally, as far as the bosses then, is it kind of like where when you get a new item, you know it's going to be key to fighting the boss, or is it more like you kind of utilize everything you have to that point?
I'd say a lot of the bosses kind of, I mean, probably because of the triumph of the sword play, is that, you know, the sword play is very good. So there are some bosses, like, for example, not to spoil too much, but in the first dungeon, the boss involves a sword fight. And, of course, you're not going to like, oh, we're fighting with swords. Oh, I'm going to shoot the beetle at you and go around and collect something. Like, you're not going to do that. Right. There's some that, you know, it's kind of like, I guess, almost rote a little bit, as in, you know, shoot in the eye to win and stuff like that. You know, we've all done that before. But there are some that use items in creative ways. But most of them, I would say, you know, requires good sword work. And they're devious. Sometimes, like, I'll be staring at a boss being like, what the hell do you do? And it doesn't really have that win button where you're kind of just like, you know, Navi's holding it and Navi's over it. You just start the boss and it'll be like, oh, look, it's if you use this weapon to do this, you're going to win. Right. Like, your character, your Navi character, which is actually like this personification of the Master Sword, which is what you're trying to build throughout the game. I don't think that's a spoiler. It's like on the friggin' box. It happens within an hour of the game starting or something like that. But she'll, like, at first just be like, oh, you know, this is this boss. Maybe you need to try to figure out something with that. And then it'll be like, do you want more info? And you click more info, and it'll just be like, ah, I got nothing right now. And then, like, as you go through the boss, you know, maybe, I think it might actually work, like, if you die and come back, it'll kind of, you know, she'll pop up and be like, ah, this is what you got to do. Sure. But it's basically, like, as you kind of, like, you know, it gives you time to try to figure it out on your own, which is, right. I feel, the great triumph of Nintendo's attempt at doing the Super Guide in general, is that it doesn't just give you the win button at the press of a button. It makes you kind of work for it. Right. And it is cool that in this game, I mentioned this in the review, that there's basically, like, a pretty deep, like, FAQ/walkthrough in the game. Because not only do you have Fi, you know, to go to for advice, and she also, like, you know, when you're in the environment, you can ask her for advice or a hint or something, and, you know, she'll give you some details about that. Sometimes it's, like, kind of vague. It seems like she does, like, you're trying to ask her about something, and she's just like, wow, this lava's really hot. And you're like, no, I want to know, you know, how I collect that item. Like, I don't care about I know it's hot. I fell into it. I was burning. Like, come on now. But then in addition to that, you have the Sheikah Stones, which if you played Ocarina of Time 3D, it functions the same exact way as it does in that, where you actually have to back out to an area. It's in Skyloft this time, and there's a few others that show up, but you'll find them when you get there. But there's one in Skyloft that you can back out to it and see the little hint video for it. But I mean, it's a pain in the ass to back out to it, but pro tip, if you're in a dungeon, just save in the dungeon, then go check the hint and then just turn the game off and reset, and you don't have to worry about getting back to the dungeon.
Well, there you go.
But that is one thing worth noting. Saving in this game is done differently, as you have to save at these bird statues that are liberally sprinkled throughout the game. Which,
that's right. Yeah, you can't just save anyway.
Yeah, I actually think it's better for the series, because you do get to that point where it's not like you save and turn off the game and it's like, oh shit, you start back off in the Temple of Time. Too bad. Use your ocarina and get there, maybe, if you got it yet.
Yeah.
In this case, you know, you just save and you basically start exactly where you saved. So it's awesome. And you can also use that to kind of get around a little bit. Although, I feel like it's a little clumsy, because, like, when you're in there's, you know, the different individual areas underneath the clouds, there will be bird statues that you find, and then when you come back to that area, you can just go to the direct area. But I don't think there's a way, like, let's say, you know, I'm in the forest and I want to get to the other side of the forest, I would have to back out to the sky and then go back down. There was no way to be, like, jump from this bird statue to this one.
Which
I feel like would have been more convenient, because I actually did use that a few times.
Right.
Yeah.
In regards to combat, and then we can move on from that. We've talked about bosses now, but what about just standard enemies that you fight? I mean, they've kind of touted so far that you kind of have to pay attention to enemy movement and attack them in certain ways or in different places. I mean, is that common, you know, no matter what enemy you're fighting? And did you find that made combat better, or did that kind of, was that grading?
It makes combat tougher. But
yeah,
like, you do get to a point where, I mean, early on, it's a pain in the ass. And that's probably where people will complain. That's where I complained. But then you just kind of learn that, like, all right, I can't screw around here. You know, I need to pay attention to what he's doing. And you do get to a point where you're just kind of like, slice right, slice left, dead. And, like, just very, very quick. And there's a few moments throughout the game where you just have to fight a lot of enemies. And, they give you enough opportunity to kind of learn how to play the game that you basically just get put in the situation that when you first started, you would just get your shit wrecked. But you just mow everyone down. It's awesome.
Right.
And right. There okay. are, I mean, at this point, I beat the game a few games. I beat the game a few days ago. And I've been just kind of, you know, thinking back on it. And there's just a lot of moments in the game where it's like, I walk into a room and, like, there's, like, arrows raining down on me and, like, enemies jumping out at me. And then I just mow everyone down and, like, you back out, you pull out the bow and arrow and you go into the first person mode and you're just like, bam, bam, got you guys. Oh, you're trying to hit me with your sword? Oh, too bad. I'm going to get you now. Like, it's so rewarding in a way that combat has never felt for me in a Zelda game before.
Wow. Okay, so yeah. So but it didn't ever get annoying to the point where you just wanted to get through enemies, but you had to like stop and slow down and take your time. Like it was.
I mean, there are some tougher enemies that you face later in the game, but once again, it's like they do have that kind of mechanic where like there will be an enemy that they kind of tout as a boss, and then you will find that enemy as like maybe like you know like two of them as a mini boss, and then near the end of the game, it's kind of like they just show up regularly. Like, it has that kind of structure. Like, I'm trying to... There was another game that I played recently that had that same kind of thing, where it was just, like, they built this one thing up as a boss, and then it just became a regular enemy as you progressed. And that this does... like, Skyward Sword does that a little bit. Not that ridiculous, but enough to... That it's worth noting.
Okay. When I think of Twilight Princess, I think with that game, they really tried to make it a very cinematic experience. You know, there are a lot of cutscenes, and I think I've talked about it before on the podcast, or at least on newscast, but specifically I think of that moment where you enter the town on your horse, and then I think it's like the goblins run away with the children, and then you square off like on the bridge, and I think it's raining and stuff, and it's just like big dramatic showdown, like, you know, from like horseback and stuff, and I mean...
And then there's like no scenes like that in the entire rest of the game. Yeah, I know what you mean now.
Pretty much, yeah, but it's...
there's a few good scenes that like I don't want to sell... I have shit on Twilight Princess a lot, and I think it deserves to get shit on, but not that much, because as I was saying about Skyward Sword earlier, it's still a fucking Zelda game. It's still really good. It's just that we hold them to a higher standard.
Right. Does Skyward Sword attempt that same sort of, I guess, cinematic feel? Or maybe even more so? Or?
The very basic thing that I have to say is that compared to Twilight Princess, one, I actually give a shit about Skyward Sword story a little bit, and also it makes sense. There was a part where it's just like, oh, look, there's like Shadow Lynx or something. And I was like, this is going to get really cool. And then it just never got followed up on. Maybe right. I missed something, but like I distinctly remember the scene and like, you know, like hitting my friend. I was playing it in college and I was like hitting my friend. I was like, dude, shit is going to go down. And then just never talked about again. Like it's just kind of like Link had this nightmare where there were shadow versions of him that were going to kill people. And like just never talked about again. Whereas this game, they kind of follow up on everything. It's a very coherent story. You know, the cutscene direction is very good. The localization is impeccable. I'm pretty sure, because I played this, I was playing a little bit of it, like, when I was hanging out with friends, so they could watch it, and there were some story parts where, like, people were calling out, like, kind of sly pulp culture references to things that I wish I could remember what was mentioned to see if other people would notice it, too. But there were just a few things where it's just like, maybe, like, that could just be a coincidence, but I think it might be referencing something else. And they do have, actually, a couple, like, Zelda series references. Like, I believe someone at some point says, like, you know, it's dangerous to go alone, take this, and they give you something.
Perfect.
And I do love the moment where, when you have like the bird race early on, the wing ceremony, which is kind of the focus of the introduction, and one of the guys talks about how like this is the 25th anniversary of our event, which is another is really cheesy, but it's really cool. And there's actually like it's down to the point where like in this game, there's actually like part of the title card is the logo for the 25th anniversary. So
oh, okay.
I mean, this game really is I mean, maybe not for every game in the series, it's kind of the culmination of it, but definitely, like, from Ocarina of Time to Skyward Sword, it's just, like, a celebration of 3D Zeldas.
And it seems aware of its own legacy.
Yeah.
Great. Well, we've gone quite some time now. I mean, I think this is pretty good, I guess. Yeah. Do you have any closing thoughts or anything you just want to say before we get out of here?
One, if you ever liked Zelda games, if you call yourself a Nintendo fan, if you want to play your Wii, like, buy this fucking game. Put that on the back of the box. Like, if you actually want to play your Wii, buy this fucking game. Neil Ronahan, Nintendo World Report. Guarantee there will be people like buying Modern Warfare 3 being like, well, maybe. I mean, I do like the Wii. I'll just get Modern Warfare 3 on Wii instead. But well, I actually had something relevant I was going to say, but then I got sidetracked by my own stupidity. But this game is really, really good. To the point that after I beat it, I, you know, did the nice thing and shipped it off to Andy so he can beat it and write about it and talk about it with me, and then, you know, be able to play it before he's his kid, which I think should happen mere days after the game officially comes out. So I'm glad to, glad to help him out, and, you know, he can make his earnest try to like beat Zelda in a week and a half before he has his kid. but I really kind of wanted to replay the game almost immediately after I played it, and I've never had that feeling with a Zelda game before. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love Ocarina, I love Wind Waker, I love Twilight Princess. I'll say loved because I don't know, like, I tried replaying that game, I couldn't do it. I actually finally got to the second dungeon, and then just kind of got bored and stopped playing. And, like, I always referred to that 3-day opening as my bottleneck, but I got past that. I still don't really want to play it anymore. It just doesn't appeal to me that much. Like, it's okay, but it's neither here nor there. But even with Ocarina of Time 3D, when I replayed that, and, you know, it's been probably 10 years since I replayed Ocarina, so it was kind of, you know, I remembered a lot of it, but it was still kind of fresh. And the only reason I played any of Master Quest was because I was reviewing it and I felt obligated to. With this one, it's like I really wanted to play that second quest. Like, I wanted to start back up again. And I guess as a final tease, they do actually tie this in to the overall, like, arc of the story, and it's kind of cool how they do it. Pretty much my immediate thoughts after watching the end credits was, I can't wait for, you know, all the rabid Zelda fans to play this game and analyze the crap out of it and see where it fits in the timeline. I can't wait to talk about, you know, this game's, the gameplay and, you know, the story and everything about it with people. So, yeah, I can't wait for people to play this game because it's super, super good, and I will be shocked if people don't love it.
Well, great. And yeah, your opportunity to talk about it at length is quickly approaching here.
So. Yeah.
So you won't be alone anymore.
Yeah. And live show next week, and, you know, send in any questions that you have and we'll answer it, you know, when we can, embargoes permitting.
There you go.
Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Just like Neil said, don't forget you can always email us your questions and comments to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. We've been loving all the feedback we're getting from you guys. We're really trying to make the show interactive, so it helps a lot when you contribute in the way that you are. Also, if you got the time, drop us a review on iTunes. We'd love it. Also, don't forget about our Child's Play marathon show next Saturday, and we'll see you next week.